This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, good morning, everyone. I apologize for the second start. My name is Mike Foyer. If you're just joining the class today, first of all, welcome. Second of all, this is a five-part series on the history of the Jews of Spain. If you're interested in part one, we're recording, and so I actually don't know if Pardes has already put it on my faculty page. The Elmad platform is Pardes' digital platform. I highly encourage everyone to check it out. It's broken up in many different ways. One of them is by faculty. You'll find everything that I do will be there. And if you have the source sheet, it should have my email on top of it, if you have the timeline. So if they haven't put up the first class and you want to hear it, you can send me an email. I'm happy to send you the link. Okay, that's just by way of introduction. In the first class, we discussed this sort of prehistory, as it were, of the Jews of Spain in the Visigothic Christian kingdom. We're going to leave that behind. I apologize if you missed out, but, you know, history waits for no one. And today, we're going to focus on the Golden Age. So if we're going to talk about the Golden Age already, then what we really need to start with is a warning. And that's a warning about the tendency to break history into manageable chunks in order to talk about it. This is called periodization amongst historians, right? The Middle Ages, periodization, right? There's the Middle Ages, there's modernity, there's late antiquity, there's all kinds of divisions, and they're helpful. It's a helpful language because then we have a unit that we can speak about. The problem with that is that it's never neutral. It's never neutral. I'll give you the best example I can. Would you rather be called medieval or modern? Right? Meaning the implications in the terms you can see quite quickly define your study, and especially for those of us who are not professors of history who have spent years and years analyzing the sort of primary documents, the very fact that I hand you something from the Middle Ages to look at, that language has already framed how you'll read it. And so therefore, when I say the Golden Age, it sounds good. Right? It sounds good. And you should know that the term the Golden Age actually first emerges amongst the German Jewish historians in the 19th century. Why? Because they were living in the middle of the, let's just be nice and call it Dirt Age. If anybody can get one of these, that's a timeline for us. Meaning, life was very hard, and in particular, they had a very big bone to pick with Christian culture. And therefore, it was appealing to them, both on an intellectual and ideological level, to look back to some era of great, I can never say the word, convivencia, right? Like getting along with Islam. Why? Because none of them had ever met a Muslim. They didn't live in the Muslim countries. They didn't know any Muslim Jews. Jews from Arab countries. So therefore, it was a wonderful, and plus, the culture, as we'll see in a few minutes, is extraordinarily rich. And so therefore, it was very appealing. But as we'll see later, they didn't create the nostalgic notion of the once upon a time of the good old days that the Golden Age implies. But I'm giving it to you as a warning, and it's one you should always keep in mind, that the breaking up of history into units is a useful tool, but it is never value neutral. And so we're going to look a little bit at why it might be known as the Golden Age. So first of all, the context, as we mentioned at the end of last class, for the Jewish people at this point in history, when I say this point in history, we're basically speaking about the 10th century, 10th and 11th centuries. So like the 900s, 1000s, right up through, as we'll speak about, maybe early 12th century. Now, the context for the Jewish people has become the Islamic Empire, right? When from the march, it's called the Hijra, Muhammad from Mecca to Medina, then back to Mecca in 622, through to the Muslim conquest of the Iberian Peninsula in 711, that 100-year period will unite 90% of the Jewish people in one language unit. One language unit, one, at least at first, bureaucratic political unit, one cultural unit. And so therefore, for the first time in quite some time, really for the first time since the fall of Rome, the Jews share both a means of transportation and communication that can tie them together and a cultural context that allows them to actually speak to each other in a meaningful way. That may sound surprising, because you're probably thinking, weren't they all Jews? And the answer is, well, that depends on what you mean, right? Don't forget this thing that we call Judaism. by which I mean a one-to-one mapping between the identity, like raise your hand if you're a Jew, raise your right hand. Raise your hand if that to you means keeping the Torah and all the mitzvot in the way the rabbis understood. Well, okay, at this point in history, a lot of people are going to raise their hands. But the further back you go in history, the less and less that mapping will be true. Right? The idea that Judaism is a religion defined by law, beliefs, behaviors, and practices was a project that began toward the end of the Second Temple period and really culminates in around the 8th century. To the point where it's a given that what it is to be a Jew is to keep the law. And to keep the law means you're a Jew. Right? As opposed to many other options that those of us who have been together for the longer class, we've been discussing this for quite some time. Interestingly enough, and I haven't quite decided if we're going to go into this, certainly not today, but just to get you to think about it, the 8th century is also the time of what's known as the Karaite Schism. Right? This is when a group of Jews stood up and said, what? These rabbis blew it, or they falsified it. They didn't really know what the Torah wanted, and they broke away, and that's, of course, already from the rabbinic perspective. Like, we are what's legitimate, you are breaking away. And created, by the way, the Karaites, at a certain point in the 10th, 11th centuries, were the majority in places like Egypt and the land of Israel. They were not, as we see them today, some strange sort of like remnant group. There was a major competitor for legitimate identity as a Jew. Right? And it happened at the exact same time this project came to end because, in my opinion, ism and schism always come into the world together. As soon as you can say, this is Judaism, then everything else by definition becomes heretical. Right? Another way of saying this is that once you have orthodoxy, heterodoxy becomes heresy. Right? If we all agree that we're Jews and we don't necessarily know why, so then there's a certain flexibility in that. As soon as we say, but this is what it is to be a Jew, well, if you're not this, then by definition you're not a Jew, right? Except if you happen to think you are, in which case you're going to insist on it and we're going to call you a heretic. This should sound familiar. Right? So these things don't go away. They're part of the sort of context that underlies our discussion. But for right now, things are rosy in the golden era. And most importantly for our discussion is going to be, as I said, Islam and Arabic culture, which should not be confused, right, as the context for Am Yisrael, for the Jewish people. What do I mean, by the way, that Islam and Arabic culture shouldn't be confused? Right? I'm reasonably sure that you guys are educated enough to know that, for instance, the Iranians are Persian and not Arab. Right? There are many more Muslims than Arabs in the world. But it's a forgivable mistake because, of course, the core culture of Islam comes from the Arab world, from the Arabian Peninsula. Nevertheless, there's one very important piece, as we're going to see going forward, which didn't have so much to do with Islamic culture, but had a lot to do with Arabic culture, and that will be poetry. Poetry takes a very important role in the relationship between Israel and the Muslim world in the Golden Age. And it is a product of pre-Islamic Arabic culture. It flourished under Islam as well. It's not like the Muslims were anti-poetry, on the contrary. But it predates the advent of Islam as a core element. The Arabs would go into battle with a herald carrying the standard on one side and the poet on the other. Because it didn't really happen if you can't sing a song about it afterwards. Right? That's not a new phenomenon. That poses a very big question for us. There are wonderful poets. Anybody know anything about some medieval Spanish poetry? No, because I can say whatever I want. But I think, I imagine that people have heard a little bit that it's a huge field. It's rich, and people are scholars in it, and there's an incredible flowering that before, really, in all honesty, the Gaonim wrote some what we call piyutim. And people who indulge in the traditional liturgy on, say, the 9th of Av, or in the slichot, the penitential prayers that are said in the lead-up to the days of Aut, to the Yomim Na'im, are probably familiar with a lot of the what's called the Byzantine-era poetry of the Jews. It's a mix between midrash, sort of rabbinic narrative weaving, and true poetry. But it lacks the style, the meter, the structure that you would open up a book of poetry and say, ah, you can even visually identify, right? When you scan. So where's the last place we see traditional poetry like that in Jewish tradition? Psalms, David, the prophets, right, it's biblical. The Bible is full of both formal poetry. That's why, say, for instance, the Song of the Sea is probably the best known. That when you hold up the Torah in shul, you can visually see by the structure of the lines that the Song of the Sea is indeed a song. Remembering that in Hebrew, the word shir functions, there is no differentiation between song and poetry in the Hebrew language. So the encounter of a culture, the Arab culture, by the Jews, which is rich in sort of both poetry in its soul, so to speak, and also tools, it's very important, tools of poetry, is going to pose a question that I want to pose as a theoretical one, and then we're going to go into sort of more information-based as we move forward, and that is, do the Jews become more Arab than the Arabs? You know, there's a funny thing about the Jews. On the one hand, we're going to see in this story there's a very strong root of particularism in what it is to be Jews, right? We're not like anyone else. We're the Jews. On the other hand, there's a line which echoes in my mind all the time, which is that the Jews are just like everybody else, only more so, right? That there seems to be this habit that the Jews will be more Roman than the Romans, more American than the Americans, more Arab than the Arabs, will have a Jewish pope, they're going to claim Elvis, they're going to do everything they can to be as much as part of their host culture as they can. They become the epitome of German romantic nationalism, right? You will see it wherever we go. And so it poses a deep question when we encounter Arabic poetry, and I want to pose that question to you because it's important on a theoretical basis. Meaning what? What happens? Do we simply come into Arab culture and say, wow, poetry, that's cool. We don't really have that inside us. We'll borrow it from you and we'll become like the Arabs. And therefore, the process of history becomes an adaptation and adoption of things that we encounter. And we'll learn poetry from the Arabs. We'll learn philosophy from the Germans. We'll, learn baseball from the Americans. I don't know what we learn from America. Well, we're going to talk about that because we actually didn't learn philosophy from the Greeks. We learned it from the Arabs, but we'll get there. That's one way of looking at our progress through exile. And by the way, that's interesting, and it might be illuminating in terms of how we became who we are, but it poses a big question, which is, who are we? Right? 2,000 years after the dispersion from Jerusalem, if you can identify the German elements, the Arabic elements, the American elements, Polish elements, okay, but at a certain point, if you clear that all away, is there a genuine identity in there? And this will lead to what historians know as a neoclassical perspective on redemption. Because if exile is about this accretion and adoption of other ways and cultures and ways of being, well then, to get back to your true self, you got to strip that all away. Anybody ever have that experience in their life? Right, this is what oftentimes people call a midlife crisis, right? It's like at a certain point, I wake up and realize, gosh, I'm not me. I'm all that stuff that everybody thinks I ought to be. My mom, my wife, my brother, my boss, all these things. I want to get back to my essential self. And there's real power in that. But realize it's an assertion that A, your essential self exists, and B, that it's your genuine self. Because I don't know about you guys, but I'm not going back to age 15. But that was really me then. Me before I learned all this stuff, me before I met all these people, me before I had all those mentors and decided I was going to act this way or that way. You understand? Nevertheless, there is a very strong element we see not just in historical studies, but in world culture of a neoclassicist notion. That meaning, by the way, the best example in European history is known as the Renaissance and then the Enlightenment. Meaning the Enlightenment is a rebirth in a more sophisticated fashion that real European culture came from the Greco-Roman world. And everything else was either a Christian overlay or it was a foreign import or whatever you have. So therefore you have both in the Renaissance and in the Enlightenment, Voltaire is one of the great examples of thinkers in the Enlightenment, this sort of return to an idealized past. And so therefore the progress of history becomes neoclassical. I'm going to take the past, I'm going to make it my future. We see this in Judaism as well. I won't make you raise your hands, but we often talk about rebuilding the temple, about a return of the Davidic kingdom. Right? I have friends who get starry-eyed when they start thinking about monarchy. Meanwhile, I tell them, read the Tanakh before you get too excited. Even though I'm a big fan, pray for it 3 times a day, but I think that we might have different visions of what exactly that means. So there is this neoclassical element, and by the way, it would imply that the poetry that was written in the Middle Ages is not Jewish. Might have been nice. Rabbi Yehuda Levi wrote some great poems, but really, He was a what we call it, a cultural stooge, right? And a real Jew writes poetry like the prophets. That's one perspective, and you will hear that perspective. You may hear it in the news today, right? Another perspective on how we relate to the progress through exile and the vision of redemption. You understand the relationship? Exile becomes this cultural, you know, adoption, accretion, and therefore a vision of redemption is we're going to chuck all that and become our genuine selves again. That's in the neoclassical. We want to be what we once were. But then there's another question, which I call cultural evolution, which is it might just be that, you know, that Arabic poetry was a trigger for something inside the Jewish people. You know, if you had never had that relationship, you've never met that person, took that job, took that trip, you never would have found that thing inside yourself that makes who you are right now. Now, it means that the context or the relationship was what triggered it, but the truth that emerges in you. You understand? So there are parts of yourself that will never find expression until you put yourself in new situations, meet new people, learn new languages, skills, etc. Right? And so therefore, even though it's true you may be adopting the Arabic method of poetry, we have a poetic side in us that would have never found release if it weren't for the fact that the Arabs have a sophisticated and deep history of poetry and tools. But why reinvent the wheel? These are great tools, and I will use them to articulate the poet in me. And therefore, the poetry I write is a genuine expression of my truth, which, by the way, would have never come out if we had not been resident in Arab culture for hundreds of years. This is a different perspective, hang on a second, on both exile and redemption. You understand? Because suddenly exile becomes useful, necessary. This is a critical question, which we dealt with a little bit at the beginning of the course, and God willing, if we're all together in a year and a half, at the end we'll speak more about it. But it's a question of why exile? And that's a big question. Right? Because there's one perspective on exile, which is it's just a failure. We blew it. And we're just trying to get back to where we were. That's the neoclassical, you hear it? And therefore, everything that happens along the way might have been great, and maybe it's useful, but we would have rather done without it. But that has quite a negative and world-rejecting implication in it. So, like, you know, I'm a believer as a Baal Teshuva, someone who came to religion later in his life, that God doesn't waste time. So therefore, you have to ask the question as a Baal Teshuva, and then what was I doing those first 20-something years that I wasn't keeping the Torah, if I really believe that I'm supposed to be doing it now? In the same way that if I want to tell you that God doesn't waste time on the national scale, we have to ask the question, what have we been doing wandering the planet for 2,000 years? So one answer is evolving, putting ourselves in situations, encountering cultures, learning ideas, making relationships, which, listen, it's not all good, don't get me wrong, but they brought out things in us that would have never otherwise been there. Yes? Sorry.
Your definition, Zionism, that is very much a neoclassical.
Well, Zionism is funny. We're gonna look at Zionism the last, because Zionism, as is true with Zionism in general, has every element of Jewish thought and history woven into it in very messy ways. But we'll get to the better example for it in a second. Professor Cohn, who was once the chancellor of JTS, I've forgotten his first name, wrote a very provocative essay, which is the benefits of this. What? I have it in my notes if people are curious. I was just working on it yesterday. The benefits of assimilation in Jewish history. Mm-hmm. Right? You can imagine that this didn't land well in the ears of American Jewry. But his point was exactly what you're saying, is that we've always assimilated, and it's actually what not only allowed us to strive, but thrive, and has brought incredible riches to us and to world culture. The real question is, do we lose our identity in the process?
Do you want to use the term assimilate,
right? Or integrate? Intellate, assimilate, acculturate, the terminology doesn't bother.
Assimilate is strong, but
assimilate, but that's because of how, it's the connotation, not the denotation, yeah.
Was this Jeremiah's stance on Babylon there?
Build houses, grow your food, live there. It could be, but I think it also could have been pragmatic, because Jeremiah, don't forget, had a 70-year window. His promise was don't give up. And we're going to talk about the importance of hope in relationship to exile.
I've read an article by A.B.
Yoshua
this past week where he explores the Palestinian Jewish issue, and he blames, it seems to me, the Jews for the exile. He basically said
Listen, it is a core element, and I encourage you guys, I'm right now in my podcast, in the Jewish story, I'm putting out the Zionist era, is a core element of Zionist historiography to blame the Jews for our passivity in the face of exile. And A.B. Yehoshua is, whatever his politics may be, a deeply passionate Zionist culturally. It's sad to me that I even had to qualify by politics. I apologize. What? Don't qualify it. No, I won't qualify it. I know what you meant. I know what you meant. Let's wait until we talk about the Khazars. Right? There's a touch there. So there's one last piece. We have this notion of the neoclassical, which is that exile was a mistake. We blew it, right? And therefore everything that we accumulated along the way might be cash in the pocket, but I'd rather spend it to get my identity back, please. Right? There's another, this what I'm calling cultural evolution. We encounter Arabic culture, and there's something in us which emerges through that relationship which could have never otherwise been, which means that exile is an evolutionary process of becoming who we are, and that therefore redemption is not a return to some idealized past, but is a culmination of arriving as who we ought to be, which could have not otherwise been without any sort of what we would call teleology. It's not like every piece had to happen, but you know, you never know what your life is about until the end. Right? That's a good story. You don't know what the story's about until you get to the end. The best example I can give to you is that when did kingship end amongst the Jewish people? Usually we say the destruction of the first temple, right? You know, if you show the arc of kingship, well, we'll start at Shaul, it goes up to David and Shlomo, and then there's like this up-down thing, but it's basically downwards. But what if I told you that actually, in 1948, boom, you thought the story was over, but you weren't at the end? You know, it's hard to know what a story is about until you see its full arc. And you don't know who you are meant to be until you get to the day you die. So there's a third piece which lies somewhat in between. It relates very much to Zionism, which is the new Jew revolutionary stance, which is we're not going back to what was, nor are we going to accept this process of evolution. We have a revolutionary vision of something which has not yet been, the messianic transformative. Now, on one hand, this is very powerful because there's freedom. And if people aren't familiar with the history of Zionism, it revolves around this creation of the new Jew. And there's definitely neoclassical elements in it, like what we call min ha-tanach el ha-palmach, right? This Zionist attitude that you go from the Bible to Jewish self-defense organized in Israel, and everything else was this like a messy period that either we'll blame people for or we'll just pretend it never happened, right? But there's another element in it, which is that you know, the Jewish people are like a seed. Well, the Torah, really, as I mentioned to you guys, is like a seed. You plant it in Poland, it grows an oak tree. You plant it in North Africa, it grows an oak tree, but looks different because the soil and the climate are different. You plant it in Baghdad, you plant it in Brooklyn, you plant it in all these places, and it's still an oak tree, but it looks different. But what if I told you, actually, until you plant it in its native soil, you don't even know what it is? Right? And so there is a revolutionary notion, which is that once you bring the people back to the land, it's not a return to some idealized past, nor is it just simply a culmination of a process of exile. It's a revolution. It's a discontinuity, which means by definition you can't know what it'll be until you get there. And that is part of the messianic ideal. It's a dangerous part because there's an explosive potential in messianism, which we'll touch on as we go forward. So this I want you to keep in mind because it poses a very important question in how we as 21, what year is it? 2008 to 57, 78? I don't know what year it is. It's Monday, though. I can tell you that because I'm here. How we relate to who we are as we have arrived to where we are and where we're trying to get to, and how we in particular try to understand this incredibly productive, culturally sort of rich period in Spain. So, okay. As I said, we're living within the Islamic world, and culturally, Am Yisrael was primed to thrive in the Islamic world by one person more than anyone else. Anybody want to take a guess? Who? Ezra. Interesting. I think I agree with you, but it wasn't what I was thinking. You're thinking big picture, I'm thinking local. Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sa'adja Gaon, the Gaonim, which we touched on a little bit last week, the thing you need to remember about the Gaonim, since it's its own discussion and we want to stay focused on Spain, is that if Spain is over here in the Iberian Peninsula, right, the Gaonim, of course, are over here in Baghdad, if you want to think of it in modern terms, right, in the land between the two rivers, in the twin academies of Sura and Pompidita, Right? The Gemara as a document is finished, but they are still the central living authority for Am Yisrael. And this is what you need to remember about the Goanim. The Goanim are the last living central authority that Am Yisrael has ever known. After the Goanim will come the period of what we call what? No, that was before the Goanim. What we call the Rishonim, right? The early medieval authorities. And the distinction between them is very simple. Is the Goanim, when people had a question, they would write a letter to the Goanim. They were the ones that pioneered this concept we call Shailot Utshuvot, responsa. They would receive questions and they would write back usually a whole book. Right? Meaning it wasn't they would write back like we say today, the SMS text, you know, like, you know, yes, you may, or no, no, no. That was what we call epistles, like Rav Shrera and other things that maybe we'll touch on later in the class. But the Gaonim were a living authority for whom the Gemara was a source text. For the Rishonim, the Gemara became the central authority. There was a decentralization of power. The Gemara goes out to Spain, to North Africa, ultimately it'll go to Europe as well, and then, you know, Brooklyn, here in the land of Israel. And no one will claim to speak for all the Jews anymore. Except everyone will claim that the Gemara speaks for all the Jews. But as we all know, here in the postmodern era, a text without a reader is meaningless. And since every reader is a product of their own context, the Gemara won't say the same things in Spain as it does in Poland. It just doesn't say the same things. I don't care if the words are the same. When you read them, they say different things. And so therefore, you will see Polish Jews, Spanish Jews, North African Jews, who will all look at each other and kind of say, funny, you don't look Jewish, or you don't act Jewish. Right? And do like we joked about last week, do Sephardim eat chametz on Pesach? Yeah, ask the Ashkenazi yeshiva guys. Right? Meaning there are real distinctions there in identity. But for now, the Gaonim are alive and well, and Rav Saadia Gaon is really the sort of literary height of the Gaonic period. I can't go into Rav Saadia. I'll stop plugging the podcast, but there's a great one on him out there. But we need to know that he set the stage for the Golden Age in two ways. Number one, Rav Saadia elevated the study of language, the Hebrew language in specific, amongst the Jews. Right? He was the first person to attempt a lexicon of the Hebrew language. It's called the Egron. Right? It was basically a rhyming dictionary, meaning it rhymed, and it was meant to use for poetry to rhyme. So he put the words together in ways in which they sounded correct in poetry. And in so doing, he began to organize the Hebrew language. Right? There's a lot more. He's also, by the way, the one who really pushed this notion that Hebrew was the original language of humanity that was forgotten by all of humanity except for Am Yisrael, a notion which has fragmentary roots in the Midrash, but was pushed very strongly by Rav Saadia. Right? And this is at the same time that Arabic is becoming a global language. It is certainly the language which the majority of the world's Jews speak. And Hebrew, of course, as a vernacular, as a sort of commonly spoken language, is on the wane. And even as a scholarly language, Arabic is rapidly overtaking it. So Rav Saadia is part of what we call the Hebrew rebirth. He's really already pushing that Hebrew should be the language of the Jewish people. We're going to speak more about language as we get into Spain. He's in Sura. He's the Gaon of Sura, which is, like I said, in Baghdad, more or less. And he becomes Gaon in the year 927. Right? The other piece, in addition to language that he adopts, assimilates, brings into the fold of the Jewish conversation, is philosophy. Now, it's true the Jews knew Greek philosophy when the Greeks were learning it, right? But we didn't like it, right? So much of the Hanukkah story has to do with what happens when you have love at sight, you love at first sight, you fall too deep, passionate for another person, you begin to lose sight of yourself. What do I mean? When the Greeks first came to the Middle East, which it wasn't then, it was Persian, right? They were led by whom? Who the great conqueror? Alexander. And who was his tutor? Aristotle. Right? It's unclear if he actually traveled with Alexander on that great journey, but what is clear is that Greek philosophy came in his wake. And I'm not going to go back through it. I'm assuming you guys know the Hanukkah story. It didn't sort of go so well for the Jews. But that was at the end. At the beginning, it was a tremendous love and fascination for another culture that had tools for seeking truth. It's just that the cultural package within which it came. It was impure, it was hedonistic, it was materialistic. Whatever, we can talk about Hanukkah next year. Right? We already talked about it this year. But the key is, in the end of the day, the stance that the rabbis took was, Ahura ish halomed et beno chachmat yavan. Cursed is the man who teaches his son Greek wisdom. And for several hundred years, that was the stance on Greek philosophy. But remember, there had been an experience of Greek philosophy as a positive thing. It was Greek cultural package that made it anathema. So therefore, where are the Greeks now in the 10th century? Gone. And their works have largely been lost. But they've been preserved through a twist of historical fate by the Muslims. Right? The Greek philosophy made it into the Middle Ages by being translated into Arabic in a process that I'm not going to detail for you right now. It's just beyond the scope of our story. And therefore, there is a re-encounter between Jewish thought and Greek thought through the medium of Arab culture. And now Arab culture, remember, they're more fanatically monotheistic than we are. And don't misjudge our relationship to Arab culture through the lens of our conflict today. Right? That it was a very positive host culture for most of Jewish history. Listen, every story has its ups and downs. But in particular, for Rav Sadia, it was a boon. It was a windfall. It was well, I'll tell you exactly what it was. Within Arab culture at his time, there was something called the Kalam. And Kalam today we would call an interfaith debate society. Right? Remember, Islam was born in the early 7th century, and it created a world empire, but like all religions, it took some time to get straight what it believed and what it didn't. And the Kalam, this interfaith debate society between Jews, Muslims, Christians, and they weren't really secular philosophers because such a thing didn't quite exist, but let's call them skeptics, was a live debate society that was attempting to reach truth through philosophical means. Within the Muslim Empire, mostly within the cities of Baghdad and the surrounding area, right? It was eventually suppressed. Once Islam got its state religion version down cold, they suppressed the Mutakalimun. If you've read the Guide to the Perplex, you've encountered the Rambam's attacks on the Mutakalimun, right? These people who were today what we would call syncretic or heterodox, meaning they're taking elements from multiple traditions and trying to fit them together into one truth. But here's what you have to know about the Kalam. I want you to picture, it's like a bad joke, like an imam, a rabbi, and a priest walk into a room, and they want to have an argument. Now today, I don't know if people do interfaith work today, I'm involved in a little bit of it, but the byword of interfaith work today is we don't talk about hard topics. It's certainly not about God. Right? This is exactly what the Kalam was not. We're after the truth here. Right? But you know what the one inadmissible evidence is for truth? Scripture. No argument from revealed sources. Why? Because my God says this, your God says that, ends with me reaching for my sword and you reaching for your club. Right? You can't resolve that. So therefore, what did they have to work with? Philosophy. Let's just be rational about this. If you can make an assertion to me and prove that it's true, well then, I'll have to accept it as truth. And what emerges from this are the two paths to one truth. That reason and revelation, at this point in the discourse, are seen to be two parallel paths which arrive at the same truth. Now today, it's a question of science and religion. If we stick together long enough, we'll talk about that. But for now, I want you to appreciate that Rav Sa'adja, he adopted the tools of the Greek philosophical discourse under the assumption that reason and revelation lead to one unified truth. And his great work, the first work of Jewish theology, in all honesty, is called Emunot V'Deot. Let's call them beliefs and opinions, is usually how it's translated. Although, the question of how you translate Deot is a deep question, also in the Rambam. Rambam has one of the sections of the Mishnah Torah is called the Laws of Deot. But what we need to know is that Rav Sadia, he koshered the Greeks, right? He took their philosophy, because it had already been stripped by history from its cultural package, And he saw the tools of, in particular, Aristotelian thought, right, as a proper path for knowing truth. And he has a whole epistemology of how he knows anything, which actually is worth just touching a couple of the elements you understand. People know what epistemology is? Epistemology is how you know what you know. It's a philosophy of knowledge. It's a philosophy of what knowing is, and then how we know what we know, as opposed to what's called ontology, which is a philosophy of being, right? Because you could have what is, and then we could talk about how do we know that, right? Later philosophy will begin to blur the edges between those two, but at this point in history, there's what is, that's a question, right? God exists, God creates the world, et cetera, fine. Now, how do I know that, and what is my knowing of it bring about, et cetera? So Rav Sajid said there's really only four sources of knowledge. Your senses, intellectual apprehension, you can read things, you can learn things that you haven't experienced. Logical deduction, where there's smoke, there's fire, meaning you know from experience that what you see is reflective of a larger phenomenon. Those are the three that make sense to everybody, right? Senses, learning, logical deduction, and then there's what he calls authentic tradition. That he says that, especially, of course, Am Yisrael, but all of the Western religions are inheritors of an authentic tradition. And he says it's one's obligation to use the first three tools to clarify the fourth. And he figured that reason and revelation would work together just fine. And in his time, indeed, they did. But did you hear the ticking bomb there? That once you put reason and revelation on the same level as tools, we're going to see as we go forward through history, it's not going to end well. So this was Rav Sajid's work. He was a giant of thought, one of the most important thinkers in Jewish history, and deeply underappreciated, in my opinion, which is why I just decided to take that minute, or 10 minutes. But for our story of the Jews in Spain, he sets the context, but as we spoke about last week, it's Chasdai ibn Shaprut who really gets the ball rolling on the Golden Age. Right, Chasdai ibn Shaprut, as we said, was the doctor to the first caliph of Cordoba, the first independent Muslim ruler of the Iberian Peninsula. On your source sheet, or on your what's it called, timeline there, Abd al-Rahman III, I think it is. Right, he's born in 882. He declares the caliphate right around the time that Rav Sajid becomes Gaon. So Chasdai, we told a little bit of his story last week. He was the doctor. He's the beginning of this whole sort of trope in European culture of the Jewish doctor, right? No, he really is. He really is. And it becomes more than a trope. It becomes a pillar of Jewish culture. It's not a joke, right? And like I pointed out to you, he never had any official position, right? Because of the whole structure of what's called the Pact of Omar, how the Jews were dhimmi. They were a second-class protected citizens, so technically were forbidden from ever serving in posts where they would have power over Muslims. But nevertheless, as I pointed out to you, that whole idea was, at least at this point in history, was more honored in the breach, meaning the Muslims needed the Jews because they conquered this huge empire quickly. They didn't know how to run it. They didn't have the skill set to be diplomats. They didn't have the language base to speak to the Europeans. And the last one, that language base, more than anything else, was what elevated Chasdai, aside from his natural intelligence and his wisdom. He spoke Arabic, Hebrew, and Latin. And that last one meant that he could be a bridge to the Christian culture, which has not gone away with the fall of Rome. Right, Christianity, in fact, the Holy Roman Empire is alive and kicking in Central Europe. And in Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul, the Eastern Roman Empire is still thriving, what's known as the Byzantine Empire. And so, therefore, these are people that need to be dealt with. And Chasdai is your man, as we spoke about last week. But for our story this week, as I mentioned, he was also the patron of independent Torah learning in the Iberian Peninsula. He's the one who, through his wealth and guidance, actually began to cultivate locally based Torah learning. Even though the Gaonim are all over here in Baghdad, and everybody agrees that they're the central authority, the reality is Spanish Jews, as we spoke about, see themselves as second to none. They are the nobility. Remember, they're the exiles from Jerusalem within their own sort of cultural memory. So the first marker in our story in that respect is Menachem ibn Saruk. Menachem ibn Saruk was a poet, he was a linguist, and he was the author of the first complete lexicon of the Hebrew language. It's called Hamachberet, right? The notebook. You still see Rashi will refer to it periodically. If you've ever seen Rashi refer to Hamachberet, right, he's referring to this document. And Menachem had originally been patronized by Chasdei Ibn Shaprut's father, Yitzchak, and then when his father died, Chasdei encouraged him to finish this work. And when the Machberet was published, it was a revolution. Like I said, first complete lexicon of the Hebrew language. Menachem assumed that the Hebrew language has two or even one-letter roots, something which is completely rejected by everyone except Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, interestingly. But nevertheless, and he was a Hebrew purist. It was like Ivrit be'Ivrit, as we say. He wrote the book in Hebrew, and he rejected the usage of any other, what we would today call Semitic languages, in order to clarify biblical Hebrew. Right? Remember, even in, and he's in the late 10th century, the ability to read the Bible had already eroded vastly. There were many words and even concepts which were just mystery. Right? Today, we live in a world where so much work has been done in translation, and those of us whose native language isn't Hebrew, when we get to a word in the Hebrew we don't understand, what do? We read the translation. But what makes you think that the translation is correct? Right? That is a lot of work. And so Menachem rejected Aramaic and, of course, the other big one, Arabic, as sources for clarification of terminology in biblical Hebrew. Okay, he had a happy life. The king's second in command was his patron, right up until his hated rival appeared on the scene. And that would be Dunash ibn Labrat. Right? Yeah?
So these documents made their way up to Northern Europe?
Absolutely. There was a significant scholarly communication between between the Tosfos and the Spanish, what we call the Spanish Rishonim. And Menachem's Machberet spread, I mean, relative to its day, quite far. So Dunash, by the way, people know Dunash's name from like Drori Kra. A lot of the poetry that we say in our Sabbath songs and in, like I said, liturgical poetry on the Ninth of Av and the Slichot creeps in from these poets. So Dunash ibn Labrat, he, of course, if you're going to become famous and you're a nobody, what's the best way to do it? Take down the big dog, right? So he writes and these things are all poetry. Like, you don't write essays in this time of day. You write sort of like attack poetry. I forget there's a term for it, but right. So he attacks Menachem in a vehement poem, claiming that number one, Hebrew only has three letter roots, and therefore he's just off his rocker basically for claiming two and one letter roots. And number two, and more importantly, that Menachem's methodology and some of his translations, or his, not translations, his definitions of Hebrew terminology are deviant from tradition and will lead to heresy. And Dunash carries the day. Dunash carries the day so much so that the story goes that Chasdei ibn Shaprut had Menachem kicked out of his house on Shabbat with all of his possessions dumped on the street, and he was out of a job. And who took his job? Dunash. So Dunash, he came from Fez, North Africa. At this point, North Africa has a thriving Jewish community just across the Straits of Gibraltar from Spain. Right? We'll return to it at the end of our story. Right? It seems, and the documentation of people's lives at this point is somewhat thin, seems he had actually traveled to Baghdad and been a student of Rav Sajagon. And he brought the sort of most sophisticated linguistic tools to the discussion in Spain. Now, I hope you don't find grammar boring. I actually find it fascinating, though I know very little about it. But I want you to appreciate the power of this struggle. These men are having battles of words in poetry, which are leading to people getting kicked out of their houses on Shabbat and dumped in the streets, right? And others being elevated to great wealth, right? And in the end of the day, Dunash had two arguments with Menachem, but both of them got stuck in the same problem. His first argument was structural, three-letter words versus two or one-letter word. History has proven that Dunash, or at least the academy, goes with Dunash. I'm about history. History's not over yet, right? But the academy is, we all learn, when we learn Hebrew, three-letter roots. The other one is that Dunash was more than willing to use Arabic in order to clarify unclear terms in the Torah, in the Tanakh, which he had received from his teacher, Rav Saadia, who was a master of the Arabic language as well. Now, that's nice, but first of all, what was the source for written Arabic in its day, to this day as well? The Quran, which means you've just said that when you don't understand what God said to you, you're going to look in the Quran. Ooh, for a people that's fighting a cultural battle against a dominant empire, that's a chancy move. Don't forget, for all the theological arguments that Jews and Muslims may be having at this point, nothing proves like success. Right? So the fact that Islam came out from being some like tribal religion in the 7th century to being a global empire within 100 years made a lot of people sit up and say, oh, gee, I know we're the chosen people and all, but things look good over there, like, you know? And furthermore, they're monotheists. It's a legalist tradition. It's not like Christianity that abandoned the idea of the commandments. It's a deeply legalist tradition which resonated with the Jews. The jurisprudence of Islam is extremely rich, right? At least in the beginnings, it was the most tolerant world religion that we had yet seen. So therefore, there was no sort of immediate stance of battle like with Christianity, right? And so there was a big draw. And so for Dunash to say we're going to look to Arabic to clarify terms in the Torah opens up a big door of cultural assimilation. And he goes one step further. He is one who takes Arabic meter, the way in which poetry is written, and introduces it into Hebrew poetry and creates what we know as medieval Hebrew poetry. Medieval Hebrew poetry is a blending of the Hebrew language and the tradition of the prophets, as it were, which is, you know, as we spoke about, the origins of Hebrew poetry, with the Arabic structure of poetry. And it created all the Hebrew poetry that we received. And he was on one hand glorified as the father of Hebrew poetry, and the other hand sort of demonized as a cultural traitor. But all this is very interesting, and it's nice information. But I want you to sense the danger that we're in. Because again, the Golden Age sounds great, but it doesn't last. Not only does it last, never forget that on the edge of this story lies the expulsion. And together with the expulsion, the collapse of Spanish Jewry. Most Jews did not leave. Right? When faced with the choice to convert or die, or convert or leave, kiss the sword or kiss the cross, you know, in the Crusades, the Jews killed their children before they would kiss the cross. Right? In Spain, they said, I'll take the cross, please. And so that's a question that we're going to have to encounter about what's the process that leads to that decision. In Spain, they kissed the cross, meaning most of them Muslim converted and stayed. It's true, and we'll speak about it. Many did leave, and many gave their lives. I don't want to deny that. But it's a question that historians will return to again and again. What was different about Spanish Jewish culture that allowed for this synthesis that was so productive and mass conversion? And what I'm pointing out to you is that language and philosophy are the foundation of answering that question. Right? Because language, of course, is not neutral. It's not just a technical tool that you use to communicate. Language is a structure of meaning in which we live. Right? People are aware of that. I want to explain what I mean. Right? A word is not a box that I put meaning into and I hand it to you and you open it up and you see what I'm talking about. If I say a word like tree, I ask someone, picture a tree right now. So in your mind, you all picture a tree, and if you could draw that tree, even though we all grew up in different places and different climates, we would all recognize what the other person drew as a tree. But what if I said mother? A little bit more complicated. How about God? See, the problem with language is that the more meaning-laden a word is, the less likely it is that you and I share the same meaning. So I can use a word like God over and over again as we're talking, and I know exactly what I mean if I've done the work, etc. And maybe you've done the work too, so you know exactly what you're hearing. But what could be happening? A complete disconnect. And in fact, I would argue that most breakdowns in communication, teaching, and relationship emerge from this problem. Is that the deceptive specificity of language. It's a word. I'm not speaking gobbledygook. I just said to you, you know, please clean up your room. Anybody ever say that one? And then one of my kids says, I did clean my room. And I say, your room's not clean. You know what the problem with this discussion is? We have completely different definitions of what clean is. I mean, it's prosaic, but it's actually quite demonstrative. And then there's a spiraling breakdown. So here, what you're having in history is a development of a common language. But once you have a common language, when I say God, and by the way, the Jews will use the word Allah in their Arabic writings for God often, right? Which today sounds like, whoa, we would never do that. But then it just meant God. In the same way, by the way, when you say God, if I'm speaking to, and I've had this experience as a tour guide with Christian evangelical groups, I learned it the hard way. You say God, it's usual. You say the Lord, they're talking about Jesus of Nazareth. So one of my friends pointed out to me, I was like, oh, and the Lord said, and they're all like, oh, well, that was good. I'll try that again. The Lord. What my friend pointed out to me later is that you know, you're striking a very different cultural chord. And notice, if you don't understand that, you're not having the same conversation. So the cultural amalgamation that language represents here is not neutral. So Dunash and Menachem represent really the turning point of that process. But on an even deeper level, on the philosophical level, both of them, you know, Arab culture, in addition to its sort of love of poetry, not in addition to, really, as an outgrowth of, has also a deeply developed approach to grammar. Right? What is grammar? Grammar is the physics of language. Right? It's the structural approach to language. And up until Rav Saadia, and certainly Menachem and Dunash, Jews had not approached Hebrew with language. In fact, the Jewish approach is better embodied by the Radak, who maybe we'll touch on later in our story, of David Kimchi, who famously said that meaning will always trump etymology. And if you don't know what a word means, and you think that grammatically it should mean X in the sentence, but that your grammatical definition changes the meaning to a sentence in a way which is unacceptable in your conceptual framework, meaning trumps etymology. I don't care what the rules of grammar say, we know what this means. So the reverse was true for these Spanish authors, right? And what does that mean? If you say that why is it a problem to say that the Torah has rules of grammar? A heretically, potentially heretical and destructive challenge. What do I care? All language has grammar, right? Why would it be a problem? One that devastated many thinkers. That the Torah has rules of grammar. That's one problem, although, you know, parsing sentences is... Well, that's the same problem. Think simpler. See, we've all been trained in liberal thought. The answer may be unavailable to you. Good, you're putting rules on God. If you tell me that language has inflexible rules of grammar, well, the Torah, as a medieval Spanish Jew, came straight from God, every single word, which meant that God couldn't have said it otherwise. He was bound by the rules of grammar. And it's the beginnings of the conflict between what we would call scientific positivism, that you can really know the way things are, and it's not negotiable. What goes up must come down, right? And it's the beginning of that challenge against revealed knowledge, right? God said it this way, and in the narrative, that's fine, I read it, and it's it. But then, Rabbi, when you drop your rabbi hat and you pick up your grammarian hat, you tell me, well, it says it this way because that's how language works. Right? That's a very different assertion, which is going to have wide-reaching implications in how we read text, and therefore, as Jews, how we try to obey God. Your theology is your own, but the Jews driving... the golden age culture of Judaism believed that the Torah came from God as we have it every word. And so therefore, the grammatical challenge, again, they didn't wake up to it in the beginning because this is an elitist project that's happening at a very high level, but it starts to trickle down. It is another ticking bomb at the base of this whole culture.
So what is the notion that God speaks in the language of men?
So the Gemara says, Da'ba Torah Shem B'Lashon B'nei Adam, right, where the Torah speaks in the language of men. And what that means is a very big question. It seems the simple way the Gemara uses the term, if people are familiar with it, Rashi brings it often to explain colloquialisms, as we'd say, is that you have to speak to a person in a way they can understand. And it's usually used by the sages to say, look, I know it says X, but we're going to tell you it means Y. Aye, Rabbi, then why does it say it X if it means Y? Because Da'bar Torah B'Lashon B'nei Adam. If it had said, you know, if the Torah put, you know, I don't think necessarily the rabbis would agree with me, but if the Torah had put the origin of species at the introduction, nobody would have understood it. So it tells you a story, because why do we want to make a story of creation? You got to know where you're coming from. And the mechanics of evolution, most people don't care. Even today, I got news for you, most people don't care. And the ones who care, most of them don't understand it. So that's fine. But on a deeper level, what will happen once you get to, say, the Maharal Miprag, and today the sort of postmodern approach, what I call postmodern orthodoxy, it says, Dabar Torah Lashon B'nei Adam means that God's Torah is infinite, what the Hasidim call the Torah HaKeduma, the primordial Torah. The one given to Moshe was the one that humanity could receive. Right? Which means that what we call the oral Torah is an ongoing revelation. It's not an interpretive process. It's a continual revelation as what changes? Language. And now, I'll come back to history, but I just want to point out to you that the battles over language that I experience here in our fair institution, gender language, the nature of language as a power discourse, if people are familiar with Foucault's work, you know, that is potentially a clarification of language which allows for a new revelation from the Torah. Potentially. And therefore a worthwhile endeavor, but one to be taken seriously. So you have this whole emergence into Spanish culture of the issue of language. On one hand, it is the hallmark of the productivity of the Golden Age. Poetry. The Golden Age is defined by poetry, and we're grateful, and we'll speak about some of the specific poets aside from Dunash and Menachem as we go forward. On the other hand, I want you to appreciate the problem, both in the sort of cultural bridge that language represents, that suddenly the Jews and the Muslims are speaking the same language, and at certain points it's going to be hard to tell who's who, right? And in this sort of theological time bomb of binding God's hand through grammar. So there's one more piece from the life of Chazdai before we move on to another leading personality to wrap things up, and that is the kingdom of the Khazars. People heard of the kingdom of the Khazars, right? Who were the Khazars? First of all, as far as we can tell, the Khazars actually did exist. That there is, at this point, significant historical evidence that round about the early to mid-8th century, a kingdom in, what? In the steppes of what we today call southern Russia, sort of north of the reaches of the Byzantine Empire, there was a very important kingdom founded on trade, if you're familiar with the post-Roman trade routes. We're not going to go into it right now. But basically that the nobility of this kingdom converted to Judaism. Now again, remember, converted to Judaism means what in the 8th century? Answer, not clear. But what it does mean is that they didn't call themselves Christians, they didn't call themselves Muslims, which were two available options at the time, and they gave up on paganism. Now, does it mean that they washed their hands before they ate bread, or that they were benching, davening three times a day? We don't know. But they considered themselves Jewish, and it became, therefore, the first independent Jewish kingdom since the fall of the Second Temple, which is impressive, and the only one from that time until the rise of the modern state of Israel. Right, but more important than the actual existence of the Khazar kingdom was its legend.
There was a little one for about 6 years in the Persian Empire.
Well, there was also one actually in the Arabian Peninsula. So if people want to talk about that, the Jews tend to pop up. They tend to pop up, and we're somewhat stiff-necked and independent people. So So you have to be careful with these notions, because the Khazars also play into a deeply anti-Semitic rhetoric about the idea that the Jews aren't actually from the land of Israel, but are descendants of European converts. So there's a lot out there, and it's going to play its important role here. So I don't want to go into it all, but... I have news for you. I bet a good percentage of us aren't Jews by blood. Yeah, listen... The whole Jew by blood thing is a sketchy endeavor at best. Unless you're a Cohen. Unless you're a Cohen. No, then like we've got actually pretty good genetics at this point with mitochondrial DNA. We've actually pretty... And recently, I mean, I hate to deviate too much, but there's been interesting research on Ashkenazi Jewry being descendants of four women. Right? And been questions in halacha with many of the Russian immigrants that if you can, through mitochondrial DNA, identify the markers of one of these four women, can't you ipso facto say that you're Jewish? There's an interesting question that's been being discussed right now at very sort of high rabbinic levels. Yes, to the Colonimus family that came over the Alps from Italy, were invited by new Charlemagne, that was his name. Okay, but meanwhile, we're in Spain, right? We're in Spain. So the legend of the kingdom of the Khazars played a very important role in Spanish Jewry, and it was Chazdai ibn Shaprut, who was reputed to have first had correspondence with them. The story goes that an embassy came from the Byzantine Empire, from Constantinople, which was south of where the Khazar kingdom was, and he asked them, is it true that there's this kingdom? And they said to him, indeed there is, and they described it to him, so he wrote letters. Now, these letters, which still exist today, they're called the Khazar correspondence, have, by scholars, been deeply attacked in their historicity. Right? Did they really happen? Did Chasdai really write them? Were the responses really written by the king and Khazars? We don't know, and the scholars will break down in camps which are strikingly ideological. Surprise, surprise. Right? But what really matters for our story is whether he wrote them or not, already, within 50 years after he died, these letters were circulating amongst Iberian Jews. Meaning, the Jews believed he wrote them, and they became a very important part of their culture. Now, why? You should know, by the way, both in Jewish and Christian culture, this idea that somewhere far away, past the Muslims, there's this free kingdom for the Christians. Anybody know what it was called? Prester John. His name was right? The Christians, this kingdom of Prester John, which is very interesting. You can Google it. It's very interesting stuff there. And for the Jews, it was this kingdom of the Khazars and ultimately the 10 lost tribes. And this idea that somewhere far away, there's a free kingdom of Jews. And it's a question we should just keep in mind, and one that's associated with Chasdai Ibn Shaprut, so it's worth mentioning. Why was it so important for the Jews, if life was so good in the Golden Era, to believe that somewhere it was better? Yeah, this idea of hope is a critical piece. Because hope is the lifeblood of survival in exile. And even though life was good, remember, as I pointed out to you last week, exile is defined by the belief that I belong other than where I am. If I don't believe I belong somewhere else, then I'm not in exile. As I've had this discussion with many of my younger students who live in America, they're not in exile. Why not? Because they don't believe they belong anywhere else. You know, they may have complicated relationships to the land of Israel, to the state of Israel, because for most of Jewish history, the assumption was, well, I don't belong here. I may settle in. I may have a good life, but, like, I'm in exile. That's because you believe you belong somewhere else. The Jews of Spain believed they belonged somewhere else, and they had to have some hope that they might someday get there. And we'll see, by the way, when the suffering of exile gets too bad, that hope becomes messianism, and it's an explosive potential. But the other reason is that there's a very big difference between the relationship between the Christians and the Jews. For the Christians, even though we're in Muslim Spain right now, but the Christians are on our map for the story, for the Christians, our conflict over the national existence of the Jewish people is the fact that we have no country, no kingdom, is proof that we blew it, that we missed the boat of salvation. And the proof is God destroyed the temple and exiled us, and as long as we stay in this degraded, exiled state, it's proof that we blew it. So therefore, the thought that there is a free kingdom somewhere is basically a way to thumb our nose at the Christians. But the Muslims, we don't have that same theological issue with. Muslims do not claim to be the spiritual Israel and replace carnal Israel, as the early Christians called it. With Muslims, I would say we have more of what I would call a socio-political issue. By the way, it is true there are some textual issues there that the Muslims claim that we distorted the text of the Bible. For instance, the binding of Ishmael as opposed to the binding of Isaac. And there's all that's its own. But really, the Muslims, as long as the Jews accept the fact that Islam is the political context for all life, we're fine. None of that, but like the Muslims like the Jews. The Jews like the Muslims. They get along. They share a common language, common culture. Right? But the idea of a socio-political freedom, and by the way, you should be thinking about the last 150 years of our relationship with Islam, that's a problem. Because to assert yourself as a kingdom, right, in classical Islamic thought, I say classical because I'm not familiar with modern Islamic thought, right, that there's only Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb. There's only the world of Islam and that which has not yet been conquered, the world of the sword. So therefore, there's no place for an independent, you can be a second-class people of the book within the Ummah, the community of faith, which can't be your own independence. And so therefore, this is an assertion that you don't rule the world. So Chasdai, as all people, passes away. And he's going to pass away from our freedom, really with our story, sorry, with from that dream of freedom. And in order to take the last half hour and really give you what I see to be the sort of richest presentation of the Golden Era, I want to speak about another personality, and that is Shmuel HaNagid, right? Shmuel the Prince. Shmuel HaNagid is really the epitome of the Golden Age in that the early parts of his life story are a bit of a mystery to us, but he really appears in our narrative, for lack of a better term, with the breakup of the Caliphate of Cordoba into what are known as the Taifa. At a certain point, this unified caliphate that Abu al-Rahman had managed to pull together falls apart, partially because of a Berber invasion. Remember, the Berbers are the tribes in North Africa. Partially because power politics being what they are. And it breaks up into a number of smaller Muslim kingdoms, which are known as the Taifa. Right? Malaga, Cordoba, Granada, all kinds of kingdoms, the details of which don't matter for us. But the sort of beginning of the story of Shmuel is when he flees the Berber invasion of Cordoba to the kingdom of Malaga. And there he is a spice merchant. It was a very common practice for the Jews to be spice merchants. Remember, the Jews play, all the way up until the height of the Crusades, the critical role of international merchants in the Mediterranean basin. Why? Because there were Jews on both the Christian side of things and on the Muslim side of things, number one, so they could cross borders. Number two, they shared a language that Jews in Iberia could communicate with Jews in Baghdad, not just in Arabic, but also in Hebrew, even though Hebrew wasn't necessarily a vernacular in the full sense. It was completely functional language. And perhaps most importantly is that, you know, it's a tough world out there. If I wanted to buy spices in the East and I start out in Spain with a donkey loaded up with gold coins, how far am I going to get? Not so far. But what if I go to my friend Shmuel in Iberia and I say, listen, here's 1,000 gold coins. You give me a letter to your cousin Shlomo in Baghdad that says I gave you 1,000 gold coins. And I'll give him the letter, and he'll give me the money, and I'll use that money to buy the spices. Then when I come back, I'll split the spices with you. You'll get your 1,000 gold coins back, and we'll make a healthy profit. And these are letters of exchange, which allowed the Jews to do business in a way that was safe and viable throughout the Mediterranean basin. So Shmuel HaNagi begins as a spice merchant. Right, as a spice merchant, it happened to be that his sort of like a shop, for lack of a better term, was right next to the palace of the vizier of Granada, the advisor to the Muslim king, Abu al-Qasim ibn al-Arif. I'm sure I'm saying that completely incorrect, right? But the story goes that the vizier's maidservant had some problems with her boss, and as she was buying spices one day, she confided in this wonderfully, you know, wise elderly spice merchant with a big beard, and he looked like a rabbi, right? And he offered to write her a letter to her boss. Now, you have to remember that in Arabic culture, writing a letter is not like dashing off an email, right? That the way in which one, the form and the style of the letter is more important than the content. So he writes this letter, and she brings it, and the vizier right away says, you didn't write this letter. She says, no, I want to meet the man that wrote this letter. And so he gets introduced to Shmuel, and he becomes his advisor. Every time the king has a problem, he goes to the vizier. Every time the vizier hears one of the king's problems, where do you go? I've got to get some spices, your majesty. Right? And he goes next door to the spice shop. And what begins to happen is that, unbeknownst to the king, Shmuel HaNagid is actually his primary advisor. Well, credit where credit is due. When it comes time for al-Arif to leave the world, on his deathbed, he admits to the king that, truth is, I'm not so smart. But this Jew next door, he's got good advice for you. And he convinces the king to adopt Shmuel as his advisor. And indeed, in a sort of a political story which is worthy of more attention, but I want to focus on culture right now, Shmuel actually becomes, when the king's sons begin to battle each other for the succession, he backs the winning horse in a very risky move, and Shmuel becomes chief advisor to the king of, I don't make the mistake, it's Granada, yes, thank you, to the king of Granada. And really, he's really king in all but name, because the rulers of the Taifa, these small kingdoms at this point, are completely hedonistic. They're living the good life. It's a wealthy culture. The good life is what they're interested in. He's not interested in ruling. He's not interested in law. He's not even interested in war. And so Shmuel becomes king in all but name, and was, fun fact, perhaps the only Jew ever to march at the head of a Muslim army. Right? In the year 1047, one of the most decisive battles in this period of Iberian history, there's what's called the Battle of Ronda, where he defeats the allied armies of Sevilla, Malaga, and the Berbers who come in from the north. And he writes a poem which is structurally and stylistically echoes the Song of the Sea, right? The great victory poem of the Jewish people. He writes a poem because Shmuel is an accomplished poet. I just want you to, I'm going to say it again because it's worth emphasizing. Perhaps the only Jew in history to march at the head of a Muslim army, right? He's in addition also a Talmud scholar. We have his Mavo LaTalmud. It's printed at the back of the standard editions of the Gemara in the section on Brachot. Right? We have significant amounts of his poetry. His poetry is reflective of his time. Some of it is religious. Some of it is war poetry. He has what are called Shirei Milchama. He has a whole set of his poetry about war. And he's got a lot of wine, women, and song verse. Right, love poetry, but also wine-drinking poetry, which was very common in Muslim poetry at the time. That should pose a question to you.
Well, the alcohol
Right. Isn't alcohol prohibited to Muslims? The answer is, aren't a lot of things prohibited to Jews, right? Meaning this is an indication of the nature of the culture in which he lived. And by the way, you should also know that this period in Jewish history, the next 100 years, produced a wealth of homoerotic poetry as well. Mm-hmm. And not subtly homoerotic. Like what are clear poem of a jilted lover. Now, there's a lot of questions among scholars. Are these reflective of an active culture? Or are they simply reflective of, which is often true of sort of homoerotic imagery, of a suppressed sexuality? Right? Everybody has their take on it.
I read somewhere that Rav Sadia wrote, Shmuel HaNagi wrote a poem during the battle?
Yeah, well, this poem at the end of the battle, he apparently wrote it at the end. Maybe he was writing the verses while he was fighting. I don't know. There's a lot of legends about him. I can't say for sure, but that is his most famous poem, that from the Battle of Ronda. But I'm not just throwing this out there for sensationalism. I want you to take seriously that many of the people like Moshe Ibn Ezra, right, people whose poetry that we say during the penitential prayers in the lead up to the Yom Yom, also wrote homoerotic love poetry. And it's important to know that, both to appreciate the nature of the culture of the Golden Age, and I think it's worth reflecting on in the nature of our present culture, right? That there's a period in Arab culture, and by the way, the Arabic poetry of this period is downright pornographic. The Jewish poetry, which has come down to us, is much more muted. But what is clear is that it was a widespread cultural phenomenon, at least within poetry, and in the rest of Europe was considered to be, that's what the Spanish do. Like Jews, Muslims, it became like a trope within European culture. And it bears reflection in the sense of, I think, a somewhat overly simplistic presentation of religiosity that often is given in the world as we know it today. But really, that's a sidelight, an interesting one, but a sidelight in his life. And I'm watching the time slip between my fingers. That's okay. Because Shmuel, in addition to being a politician, a warrior, poet and scholar, which is just like, sit with that for a second, it's an astounding accomplishment. He was a huge patron of Jewish learning, which was something, this is a model, and he wasn't called Hanagid for nothing. That title in Jewish culture was first given by God, right, to the king Shaul, when he says to the prophet Samuel, I will choose a Nagid on my people. That is a king in all but name, as I said. Right? And it is a model that Iberian Jewry will follow up until the day of the expulsions. The average Jew had no recourse to power. It is not a democratic society. So they were completely dependent upon these unique individuals who, through their skill set, through their wealth, and through their circumstance, were able to sort of work their way into the halls of the king, and sometimes, like I said, right up next to the throne. And Jewish life would be entirely dependent upon whether these people were moral, upright, still cared about their nation, were interested in a flourishing Torah culture. And Shmuel Nagi becomes the gold standard for someone who was indeed all of those, right? Two personalities that are worth at least touching on that he really brought into the world. One is Rabbeinu Bachya. Rabbeinu Bachya Ibn Fakuda, famous for what work? Anybody know? Excellent. Chovot HaLevo, duties of the heart, right? Chovot HaLevo, duties of the heart, as opposed to what he calls Chovot HaEvarim, the duties of the limbs, meaning there are lots of mitzvot in the Torah, lots of things you have to do. We're going to speak, if we get there, at the end, if not at the beginning of next week, about why that's so important. But Rabbeinu Bachya noticed what we call a lacuna in Jewish thought. It was a big gaping hole. No one had ever written a systematic presentation of Jewish spiritual ethics. It didn't exist. And so therefore, he brings together in Chovot HaLevavot with all of Jewish lore, massive amounts of rabbinic thought, and interestingly enough, significant elements of Sufi thought. And Rabbeinu Bachya is held up today as one of the great examples of cultural synthesis. That there are whole sections of Chavot HaLevavot, and this is not contested, because you can just put the manuscripts next to each other at this point and see. Whole sections. I want to actually get the name of the Arabic tract correct. There's a group of Arabian encyclopedias known as the Brothers of Purity. I didn't actually write down the name of the book, but there are significant sections of his ethical work, which he took straight out of Sufi thought. even though the Sufis rejected philosophy. They were actually very different than the rest of Islamic thought in their day. They were mystics, but a mystic, as we're going to see, mystics don't necessarily reject philosophy. We'll get to Ibn Gabirol in a second. But he not only accepted philosophy, but in the footsteps of Rav Saadia, in his introduction, says that actually a real religious life cannot exist without a rational philosophical life. That the two must come together. Again, he's operating on Rav Saadia's belief that revelation and reason are two paths to the same destination, and they are meant to work together. But his focus really was on the ethics, the inner experience of life. And by the way, if you've never read Chovot HaLevavot, I highly recommend it. It is a beautiful, of all the works of medieval Spain, most of them are sort of like just culturally inappropriate, so to speak. They're just talking to a different world. But Chovot HaLevavot is timeless. It's timeless. And I give it to you as a sense of both the type of what? Chovot HaLevavot, duties of the heart. And give it to you as an example of not only a very important development in culture that was happening in the Golden Age, but under the direct patronage of Shmuel HaNagid. And as long as Aviva brought up this question of mystics and philosophers, sort of his earlier contemporary, actually his later contemporary, so he was younger than Rabbeinu Bachya, was Rav Shlomo ibn Gabirol. Gabirol, it's a little bit hard to know exactly how his name was pronounced. Most people have never heard of him, which is not surprising, because he was a both mystic and philosopher. He was the source of what we call Neoplatonic thought within Jewish tradition. Now, if you don't know anything about philosophy, don't be nervous, right? Neoplatonic thought, Plato as opposed to Aristotle, Plato believed that the whole world was an emanation of one thing. And that in those stages of emanation, you get progressively away from the infinite unified one toward an increasingly complex, imperfect, you know, and changing world. But the backbone of Neoplatonism as not a philosophy but as a mystic practice is that through ecstatic contemplation, one can rise back up through these levels of existence to a union with the one, which happens either through ecstatic union or death. And so the philosophers believe then if you had right conceptions, proper moral behavior, and a little bit of imagination, right, that you could actually achieve union with God to the extent that the individual can, because it's really a loss of selfhood, right? This remains its reflection. People are familiar with this idea of the Platonic ideal, that the truth of this thing we call horse, there's this thing which is the ideal horse, and then there's all these horses in the world which are a imperfect manifestation of the idea of horse. So it's a somewhat simplistic presentation of what underlies especially Neoplatonism, because it's a practice. It becomes this idea. And by the way, if anybody's familiar with the modern formulations of Kabbalah, the idea that the world is a progressive series of emanations from a unified God, you sense that it's probably, we don't know because it might actually predate him to the Gnostic period, but it's probably Rav Shlomo ibn Gabirol who introduces Neoplatonism as a basis for what eventually also emerges from Spain, which is the Kabbalah. And this whole idea of what are called the 10 Sphirot, the 10 emanations, which all are progressive layers of unfolding of divine will, is, according to many, not just academics, but even traditional thinkers, is simply Neoplatonism in a Jewish guise. And they're not upset about it. So what's really interesting for his story is that in his day, he was quite well known. He was a poet. He was also apparently a terribly cantankerous personality who eventually was murdered by an Arab rival. The story is that he was murdered because he was so sort of like mean and full of himself, and that his rival buried him under a fig tree, and the fig tree flourished to such a degree that everyone said there's something up with that fig tree, and they dug under it and they found his bones, and they sort of like executed his murder. But like these are the legends that accumulated on me. They won't tell the stories about me, right? Again, for the picture of what's happening in Spanish, aside from the fact that he wrote Shir HaKavod and Shir HaYichud, if people are familiar with those from the liturgy, I mean, his words are present in our mouths today, which is true of many of the Spanish authors, is that he wrote Makor Chaim, The Source of Life, which is a treatise on form and matter in the classic Neoplatonic style. But apparently he wrote it in Arabic. It was translated into Latin, and the name of the author was lost. And this Latin Makor Chaim became what's known as Fons Vital, and became a primary text of Catholic scholasticism in the Middle Ages. So you have all these Catholic monks in the schools of, if you're familiar with Thomas Aquinas, and you know, learning the basic of their basis of their theology from Fons Vital, which they believed was a sacred text, which had been written by a rabbi in 11th century Spain. But no one knew until the 19th century, the Hebrew version of Makor Chaim was discovered, the connection between the names was made, a textual analysis was done, and it's been proven by scholars, at least, into their conclusive evidence that he indeed was the author. He disappeared. He became a pillar, a foundation stone of Western Christian culture, and then reemerges later in the 19th century as a Jew. Right? And this is so much of what's happening in the Golden Age. And when we get a little bit further, it'll be next week, we'll speak about what's known as the Toledo School of translators, not Toledo, right? Toledo. I'm from Ohio. Which was a bridge across which Latin passed into Hebrew and Hebrew passed into Latin, and everything went from Arabic back into Latin to Greek, and there was this incredible mix, an attempt to create what we would today call a multicultural intellectual environment. So these are, I just give you as two examples of Shmuel and Nagid, but the story is so long and rich that I don't have a choice but to cut it short. I have about 10 minutes, like 9 minutes left, and I really want to end with the true bridge from the Golden Era. Because, you know, it's always a question, like I said, periodization, it's a tough word, is a problematic endeavor because you always have to decide when does an era begin, when does it end. And that decision is a value-based decision. So if I'm going to say that the Golden Age begins with Chasdai ibn Shapru because he was the patron of independent Torah learning and language and culture for the Jews, and of course, remember, deeply tied to power, I'll say that it really ends with Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, who wasn't anyone's patron, nor was he tied to power. So who was Rabbi Yehuda Levi, and why is he a workable place to end our story? Well, he was born in Toledo about 10 years before the Reconquista. Maybe I should stop before I say this. Shmuel and Nagid, end of the Shmuel and Nagid story. Sorry, back up. If you're listening now, don't be confused. So Shmuel and Nagid dies in about 1056. I might have put the dates on there. I think it's 1056. Ooh. 2 points, right? And he has a son, Yosef. His son inherits his position of power, but not his good sense or his modesty. And apparently he was greatly hated because one of the important roles that the Jews played was as tax farmers. I explained this concept to you guys last week, but I'll remind you, a tax farmer is someone, the king says, I believe I could get $1 million a year out of this kingdom. I don't know how to do it. So the tax farmer says, well, here, Your Majesty, here's $1 million. You take that. I'll collect the taxes. And the king gives him an armed guard and absolute authority to get whatever he wants. Right? And so to the extent that he wants, he can really suck the country dry. Now, a smart, wise person who sees himself as the sort of shepherd of his people won't abuse that power. But if what you're interested in is getting rich, then there's no faster way. And apparently, Yosef erred on the side of cruelty and in the eyes of the Muslims of his time, favored the Jews over the Muslims, which was a sort of capital sin in the literal sense. Because what happened was in the year 1066, riots were broken out. There's some famous, sort of what we would today call anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish poetry that was written in Arabic at the time. Riots broke out in Sevilla. I just want to in Granada. I didn't think it was Sevilla. I was about to, in Granada. Yosef is killed. His body's hung from the walls of the city. And according to the contemporary reports, which you have to wonder if they're accurate or not, but thousands of Jews are killed. And it really marks the beginning of the end of the Golden Era. That's 1066, and within 20 years, Toledo, which was one of the most important cities of Muslim Spain, falls to the Reconquista. Right? What is the Reconquista? Is the Christians were pushed back, but they had not disappeared. The Christians were pushed back by the Muslim armies all the way, if you're familiar with European history, as we were speaking about before, in the year 732, Charles Martel, Charles the Hammer, right, stops the Muslim advance at the Pyrenees, and he really defines the boundaries of what becomes Christian Europe. Well, it took 300 or so years, but the Christians are making a comeback. And they begin to march out of the north. Once the caliphate breaks up into these taifa, they're getting all mixed up into the inter-Muslim wars, intra-Muslim wars, and divide and conquer is a very old tactic. And the city of Toledo is a turning point in the Reconquista. In 1085, Toledo falls to the Christian armies. And suddenly, half the Iberian Peninsula is in the hands of Christians. The Muslim world panics. 1085 is the fall of Toledo. 1091, elsewhere, is the fall of Sicily. If you're familiar with European history, Sicily was a huge loss to the Muslim world. And 1099, the fall of Jerusalem to the Crusaders. Which means within 15 years, Islam went from being sort of a lean into your conquest, take over the world mode, to, whoa, we're back on our heels. Where did these crusaders come from? And even though most people tell you that the first crusade happened, began in what year? 1096, it's wrong. First crusade began in 1085 with the fall of Toledo. The crusades weren't limited to the attempt to retake the Holy Land from the heathen. Right? Really, the crusading energy begins in the Reconquista in Spain. It's true that we make a distinction between the Reconquista and the Crusades, but it's a bit of a false distinction. So I can see now that I'm not going to confuse you with Rabbi Yehuda Levi. So it's important to see this picture, is that with the destruction of the Jewish community of Granada, right, with the massacres in 1066, and the increasing advance of the Christian armies from the north, life for the Jews in Al-Andalus, Muslim Spain, becomes increasingly tenuous. It gets worse when the leaders of the taifa of these independent Muslim kingdoms realize that they don't have the backbone to hold off the Christians. They, in a pattern which will repeat itself a number of times over the coming centuries, call for reinforcements from the Berber tribes of North Africa. Right? These, at this point, the kingdom that emerges, I'm not going to mispronounce the word, is the Almohades. No, that's later. Oh, okay. That's exactly the distinction I was trying to make. Okay. That's the time of the Rambam. I can't say Almoravids. You'll forgive me, I don't speak Berber. So the Berbers come in, and they manage, in fact, to a certain degree, to reunite the taifa into one kingdom. But there's one thing about the Berbers that wasn't true about the Muslims in Spain, is that they were really into their Islam. They were purists. Not only were they purists, they were moralists, because they had a judgment shared by a lot of the Muslim population of the peninsula that the leaders of the taifa were weak because they had lost their faith, and they'd given into hedonism and a seeking after the good life. So therefore, when they came in, they rigidly enforced the Pact of Omar and reduced the Jews to the second-class citizenship, which in their minds they were meant to be kept in, which meant that the Golden Age ended like that, right? Because suddenly the ability to reach the halls of power that had kept Jews not only safe but culturally vibrant was lost. The doors were shut. And so this is the point at which we start seeing large numbers of refugees leaving Muslim Spain, heading to the northern Christian kingdoms to seek refuge, and they're the ones, and we'll speak about Rabbi Yehuda Levi at the beginning of class next week, they're the ones who already begin to cultivate the notion that there was once a golden age. So even though I said it was the German historians of the 19th century who really create this phenomenon, which is true, you should appreciate the fact that the idea that it was better when, right, is often a response to it's difficult now. And we want to be very wary idealizing the past in light of the problems of the present. Why? Because as I began the class with, it will often set us up for a future that we don't necessarily want. Right? And so just to be clear here, that really is the sort of package of the Golden Age of Spain, the problems of language as a cultural amalgamation, the challenge of philosophy and this tension between reason and revelation. These we're going to come back to, particularly in the person of Rabbi Yehuda Levi, but we will do it next week.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.